The 100 Years' War, the De Guiscolin period. English situation, 1372 to 1373, part 1. When Parliament opened at Westminster in the beginning of November of 1372, it was Guy Bryan, an experienced and well-liked soldier with no personal responsibility for the disasters of the summer, who was charged with the task of explaining what had gone wrong. There were, in fact, a large number of reasons for the English defeat, including misfortunes and misjudgments of a sort of inseparable from the conduct of war. But the main theme of Bryan's address, which extended over the best part of two sessions, were the lack of means to defend Aquitaine and the poverty of England's naval resources. Parliament sat for 3 weeks. Most of this time must have been devoted to a lengthy post-mortem on the events of the summer and plans for the recovery in the following year. Guy Bryan's diagnosis of the problems of Aquitaine is confirmed by the copious records generated by the English war effort. The loss of Poitou and the Santage had deprived the principality of its most productive provinces, and what remained was incapable of financing its defense. The clerks who reported the revenue of Aquitaine after the prince's resignation found that it amounted to less than £1,500 sterling a year, which was barely a 20th of the prince's internal revenues in 1368-69. Only the districts around Bordeaux still accounted to the treasury of the duchy. The wine customs, which accounted for much of the duchy's receipts, had fallen catastrophically. The pound of Bordeaux, traditionally worth 4 sterling, had now become devalued to 2 sterling 8 at a fall of a third. This was perhaps the lowest point of the duchy's financial fortunes, but they never improved by much. For the next 2 decades, its revenues were never to exceed £2,500 sterling a year, which was hardly enough to pay for an internal administration, let alone its defense. Between October 1372 and April 1374, the seneschal, Sir Thomas Felton, personally funded the government of Aquitaine to the tune of more than £8,000, presumably by borrowing on his own credit and paying his retinue out of his own pocket, an extraordinary contribution for a Norfolk knight with broad acres and rich patrons, but no great fortune. The duchy was now more heavily dependent on England than it had ever been previously, but in the 3 centuries of its history, Felton's enormous deficit was ultimately repaid from the English customs. In the long run, exchequer subsidies would be required to pay most of the ongoing costs of the duchy's government. Nor was Gascony's dependence on England only financial. Almost all the famous Gascon captains were dead or in prison, or had transferred their allegiance to the French. In the following years, the English kings found themselves employing Englishmen not just as provincial seneschals and receivers, as the prince had done, but as captains of the most significant garrisons. The defense of the region against any major French offensive would depend on the dispatch of troops from England. Even the duchy's food supply depended in difficult years on exports of grain from England. Now that the grain-growing regions had been lost and the traffic of the river valleys had been disrupted by war. The other elements of Guy Bryan's lament, the decline of English sea power, probably struck a stronger chord than the fate of Aquitaine. The main conclusion which the English ministers drew from their defeats in 1372 was that their naval forces were completely inadequate for confronting the French and Castilian galley fleets now ranged against them. This was a more intractable problem. Or rather, it was 2 problems, one relating to the protection of the English seaboard trade, and the other to the defense of the long-exposed coastline of England. By 1372, and probably earlier, armed convoys were operating both in the North Sea and across the Bay of Biscay. The expense of escorting ships and their complements of soldiers was met by a special levy, tonnage and poundage, on cargoes, which were passed straight on to the shippers in higher freight charges, together with the cost of double crews required by merchant ships in wartime. The result was a rise in costs, which fell ultimately on producers, depressing their margins in already difficult trading times. Coastal raids then added to their woes. There had been 1 damaging attack on the Solent by French galleys and barges in 1369, and another less damaging in 1370. In the following year, there had been a brief and violent naval war with Flanders, provoked by some piratical incidents between English and Flemish seamen. Squadrons of Flemish merchantmen had landed raiding parties, several hundred strong, in Yorkshire and Dorset, and escaped with impunity after inflicting a good deal of damage on nearby settlements. The political impact of even occasional coastal raids or losses at sea was out of all proportion to the damage actually done. The most effective defense was actually to attack the enemy ships in their ports. The English had often tried to do this, but they had only once succeeded, and that was in January of 1340, when they had destroyed almost all the French galleys as it lay beached on the Boulogne harbor. The French were not caught out like that again, and in the late 14th century, their war fleet was well protected in the arsenal at Rouen or within the seawalls at Harfleur. Generally, the English admirals were obliged to conduct errant scouting expeditions with fast barges and sweeps of the channel with small fleets of requisitioned merchant ships, all in the hope of a chance encounter with the enemy at sea. These campaigns were exceptionally expensive and almost always fruitless. They required a carelessly exposed enemy, outstanding in intelligence, and a fleet armed and ready to act quickly, ideal conditions which were rarely encountered. Some in time of danger, coast guards waited day after day beside unlit beacons on clifftops, waiting for the appearance of French raiders. Coast guard duty was boring, unpopular, and often evaded. The commons complained about this too. Yet the results of so much effort were notoriously patchy. The Solent was heavily defended after 1370. Elsewhere, it took up to 24 hours to collect the local levies and even longer to bring in reinforcements from inland. By the time they arrived, the invaders had usually taken their spoils and vanished. After the disasters of 1372, the English government devoted a growing share of its slender resources to naval operations. The solution, according to Edward's ministers, was to build up a specialized fleet of oared vessels on the model of other Atlantic powers. They might have been less impressive by the potential of these vessels if they had known about the difficulties which France and Castile had encountered in operating them in northern waters. One advantage which they undoubtedly possessed was they were less affected by the winds. Guy Bryan blamed the contrary wind for naval disasters in 1372. This became an article of faith with Edward III's council. England already had 20 relatively small oared barges, most of which belonged to the Cinque Ports or various private enterprises. In the first few days of the new Parliament, the king was authorized to order the construction of 15 large new barges in designated ports of the eastern and southern England at the expense of the ports themselves. Several ministers and courtiers, including Latimer, Buxhill, and William Neville, also built and fitted out barges at their own expense. Some of these were very substantial ships. Paul of London, of which we have a particularly complete description, was about 80 feet long with 80 oars, equipment for 60 archers, a great mast, and three fortified topcastles. At the same time, the king embarked on the construction of the new galley of 180 oars in a great pit by the River Stour outside Canterbury. This vessel, later called the Catherine, was comparable in size and standard to Mediterranean galleys of Genoa and Castile. She was for some years the pride of the royal fleet. The government hoped for better things by forging an alliance with Genoa, the major galley power of the Mediterranean, which Edward III's ministers hoped might play some role for England as Castile did for France. In spite of the botched intrigues with disaffected Genoese exiles earlier in the year, relations with the Republic were reasonably cordial. Genoese merchants had important commercial interests in Bruges and the Low Countries, which depended on the free passage of their merchant fleets through the Channel. The Republic was sensitive to this fact now that the English controlled both sides of the Narrows. The new Doge, Domenico de Campo Fragoso, had already undertaken not to support the French or Castilian war effort, and there is some evidence of active support for the English cause. Martin Canteo, a member of the prominent Genoese mercantile family, recruited more than 450 crossbowmen and oarsmen for the English government during the winter of 1372-73. Most of them appear to have been found in France and the Low Countries among the Genoese mercenary companies in French service. Antonio Doria, who brought a company of 90 men to England, had been the captain of the Duke of Anjou's crossbowmen in the March of Gascony for 2 years before. In the autumn of 1372, the Doge's brother, Pietro, Admiral of Genoa, let it be known that he was willing to bring the whole squadron of fighting galleys to England on suitable terms. It was decided to take him up on the offer. Jacopo Provana was sent to Italy, this time accompanied by a prominent Genoese merchant who was in with the regime and poet Geoffrey Chaucer, then a squire in the royal household. The high priority now being assigned to the war at sea was signaled early in 1373 by the appointment of William Montague, Earl of Salisbury, to command an enlarged Channel fleet during 1373, with both admirals serving under him. Salisbury was one of England's most experienced commanders with a distinguished military career going back to the Crecy campaign of 1346. He also had a certain amount of experience in fighting at sea, having commanded squadrons in the Channel in 1370 and 1372. He was much more a considerable figure than the men who were customarily entrusted with purely naval operations. The English government's ambitious plans for fighting at sea in 1373 were combined with fresh projects of conquest on the continent. In the final days of the autumn Parliament, it was decided to approve to dispatch a large expeditionary force, initially expected to be about 4,000 men, under the command of John of Gaunt. The plan appears to have been to land the army in Brittany and re-establish John de Montfort's position in the duchy. Gaunt would then cross the Loire River at Nantes, invade Aquitaine at Basse-Poitou. This was essentially a fresh attempt at the strategy of 1369 and 1372. In Gaunt's own mind, this venture was probably intended to be a prelude for a yet vaster enterprise, namely the invasion of Castile over the Pyrenees from Gascony. The weakness of these grandiose designs, as always, lay in the arrangement for financing them. The commons remained intensely suspicious of the government's financial management and inclined to look for cheap victories. They renewed the wool tax for another 2 years and grudgingly added a lay subsidy of 1/10 and 15th when told that it would not be enough. Even so, tax revenues and customs combined to be expected to bring in barely £100,000 in the course of the year of 1373, of which about 2/3 would be available for war expenditures based on past experience. A comparison with the French government spending plans is revealing. Although 1373 was a lean year for the French government's finances after the efforts of 1372, Charles V's council, meeting at the same time as the English Parliament, resolved upon a budget for the coming year of 600,000 francs, about £100,000, that was allowed from the Royal Treasury for field and naval operations alone, on top of the cost of maintaining some 50 garrisons. A rough estimate of French war expenditures in this period, which is all that can be attempted, suggests that it was running at least twice the level of England. So we'll see how this continues next time. Now the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylans, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.